Truth. Generally, people who are attached to the bodily conception of life are so absorbed in materialism that it is almost impossible for them to understand how the Supreme can be a person. Such materialists cannot even imagine that there is a transcendental body which is imperishable, full of knowledge, and eternally blissful. In the materialistic concept, the body is perishable, full of ignorance, and completely miserable. Therefore, people in general keep the same bodily idea in mind when they are informed of the personal form of the Lord. For such materialistic men, the form of the gigantic material manifestation is supreme. Consequently, they consider the Supreme to be impersonal. And because they are too materially absorbed, the conception of retaining the personality after liberation from matter frightens them. When they are informed that spiritual life is also individual and personal, they become afraid of becoming persons again. And so they naturally prefer a kind of merging into the impersonal void. Generally, they compare the living entities to the bubbles of the ocean, which merge into the ocean. That is the highest perfection of spiritual existence attainable without individual personality. This is a kind of fearful stage of life, devoid of perfect knowledge of spiritual existence. Furthermore, there are many persons who cannot understand spiritual existence at all. Being embarrassed by so many theories and by contradictions of various types of philosophical speculation, they become disgusted or angry and foolishly conclude that there is no supreme cause and that everything is ultimately void. Such people are in a diseased condition of life. Some people are too materially attached and therefore do not give attention to spiritual life. Some of them want to merge into the supreme spiritual cause, and some of them disbelieve in everything, being angry at all sorts of spiritual speculation out of hopelessness. This last class of men take to the shelter of some kind of intoxication, and their affective hallucinations are sometimes expected as spiritual vision. One has to get rid of all three stages of material consciousness: attachment to material life, fear of a spiritual personal identity, and the conception of void that arises from frustration in life. To get free from these three stages of the material concept of life, one has to take complete shelter of the Lord, guided by the bona fide spiritual master, and follow the disciplines and regulative principles of devotional life. The last stage of the devotional life is called bhava, or transcendental love of Godhead. According to Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1, 4, 15, and 16, the science of devotional service, ado shraddha tata sadhu sangha ta bhajana kriya tato nartha nivritti syat tato nishta ruchis tata tata shaktis tata bhavas tata prema yad danchiki sadakanam ayam premna pradura bhave bhavet krama. In the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for self-realization. This will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master, and under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. By execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment, attains steadiness in self-realization, and acquires a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna. This taste leads one further forward to attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava, or the preliminary stage of transcendental love of God. Real love for God is called prema, the highest perfectional stage of life. In the prema stage, there is constant engagement in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. So, by the slow process of devotional service, under the guidance of the bona fide spiritual master, one can attain the highest stage, being freed from all material attachment, from the fearfulness of one's individual spiritual personality, and from the frustrations that result in void philosophy. Then one can ultimately attain the abode of the Supreme Lord. Translation again. Being freed from attachment, fear, and anger, being fully absorbed in me, and taking refuge in me, many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me, and thus they all attained transcendental love for me. So, most people in the world are affected by or afflicted by raga, material attachment. And because of their material absorption, they do not take much interest in spiritual life. There are so many people in Escondido, in Oceanside, La Jolla and San Diego. They could have come here tonight if they wanted to, but very few have come. But if you, I mean, I'm not suggesting it, but hypothetically, if you go to the nightclubs, the cinema halls, the restaurants, you would probably find many more people, because that's what they are interested in, sense gratification. And when they hear about Krishna and the spiritual world, they cannot believe it is true. They think it is a fairy tale. They think it's a fairy tale because they're so absorbed in the body, they cannot conceive of spiritual personality. They think body means material. They cannot go beyond the idea that body means material. So if they hear that Krishna, for example, lifted Govardhan Hill, as he did, they think that it's just a fairy tale, a myth. Because no one with a material body can lift a mountain. So they think it's a myth. If they hear that Krishna married 16,108 queens and expanded himself into 16,108 forms to be with each queen in their individual palaces, and then in the morning the 16,108 Krishnas came together as one Krishna and went to the Sudharma Assembly Hall to preside over the affairs of state as the king of Dwarka. They cannot believe it. They think that this is mythology. And when they see that we believe it and take it very seriously and have dedicated ourselves to this person who appears to them to be imaginary, they cannot relate to it at all. Then how to explain it? Because many intelligent people have taken to Krishna consciousness. In this room, there are so many talented and intelligent people who can dance, who practice law, who know how to make money, who can play music. And so many talented and intelligent people are here. So how to explain it? That they're worshipping some mythological figure? Well, they're brainwashed. It's obvious they're brainwashed. Their intelligence has been stolen by some hocus hocus that has brought them under the spell of some illusory belief. It's just the opposite, of course, of the way we see things, or the way Krishna sees things. They are Maya Aparita Jnana. Their intelligence, their knowledge has been stolen by Maya. And therefore, there's this difference of opinion. In the very early days of Krishna consciousness in New York City, two brothers joined Srila Prabhupada, and their mother came to meet Srila Prabhupada to complain, because they came from quite a respectable, affluent family, and they were expected to follow in the footsteps of their father and become rich businessmen. So she went to Srila Prabhupada and complained. She said, "My sons have become crazy." So Srila Prabhupada spoke with her for a little while, but then he had to give the class in the temple. And the subject of the class was, who is crazy? Who is crazy? Are we crazy, as they say, or are they crazy? And Srila Prabhupada gave a very apt definition of crazy, because you can't just indiscriminately say you're crazy, no, you're crazy. What is the definition of crazy? When we know the definition, then we can see who fits. So Srila Prabhupada posed that the definition of crazy is someone who does not know who he is. It's like in insane asylums, we have images of people going around, you know, I'm Julius Caesar, I'm Napoleon Bonaparte, or I'm Theodore Roosevelt. So they're crazy, because they don't know who they are. And then, of course, Srila Prabhupada explained very scientific and reasonably and rationally that we are not the body, but we are the soul within the body. And the soul is part and parcel of Krishna, and therefore is eternal servant of Krishna. But on the most basic level, the living entity is a spiritual being, a jivatma. That is his identity. And if he doesn't know who he is, if he thinks he's something different from what he is, then he's crazy. It's just like someone thinking, I'm Mahatma Gandhi. Not Mahatma Gandhi. So everyone who thinks, you know, I'm Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, or in the bodily concept of life, which is almost everyone, is crazy. They don't actually know who they are. They think they're someone else. So, in order to take to spiritual life and ultimately develop transcendental love for Krishna, which is the ultimate goal, one has to become free from this deep material attachment, raga. Then there are a few, not many, but there are a few who are frustrated with material life. I mean, everyone's frustrated, that's understood. But they're frustrated, but they think that It didn't work out because they didn't find the right partner, they didn't get the right job, they just didn't do it right. They still have faith in the pursuit of material enjoyment, but they think that they haven't quite figured it out. But if they keep working at it, eventually they'll hit the jackpot and they'll become happy. But this other category, fearful existence, they're frustrated with material life to the extent that they have given up false hopes in material existence based on the body. And in a way, they are more intelligent than the gross materialists. And they understand that this pursuit of happiness based on the body leads ultimately to frustration and disappointment. And therefore, we should not pursue vain hopes for material happiness, but we should give up material desires and merge and become one with Brahman, one with the impersonal light. So from a certain point of view, they are more elevated than the gross materialists. But theirs is a fearful stage of existence. They are afraid of being persons because they associate being persons with suffering. And that's true. Materialistic persons do suffer. They have no idea of spiritual personality, that God is a spiritual person, Krishna is a spiritual person, and we as his parts and parcels are also spiritual persons. But our eternal spiritual individual identities have been covered by illusion. They think that when you're free from illusion, you realize that you don't exist. You just merge and, you know. So when they hear that in spiritual life, in the liberated condition, there's personality, they become fearful. They want to run away. And Srila Prabhupada gives the example that a cow may be caught in a fire in a barn. And thereafter, whenever the cow sees that color, red, orange, the cow becomes fearful and runs away. Because the cow thinks, oh, it's fire has come, let me run away. The cow cannot understand that not all red and orange color is fire. But that color reminds the cow of fire. The cow thinks, oh, it's fire, and becomes afraid and runs away. So the impersonalists, the Mayavadis, are like that foolish animal. They see personality, I'm suffering because of personality, let me run away. They cannot understand that there is a difference, that all personality is not the same. It's like every red color is not fire. So not all personality is the same. There is such a thing as spiritual personality. But just the thought of personality, they run away. And so this is a fearful stage of existence. Srimad Bhagavatam explains that fear, maya, is caused by dvitiya, by thinking that something can exist apart from Krishna. I mean, materialists are also fearful. They're fearful in a different way. They're fearful for the body. This eating, sleeping, baya maitun, baya, that means fear. Defending, we say defending, but defending is based on fear. I'm afraid, so I'm always defending. It's everywhere, but especially in more affluent neighborhoods. See, big fences. This is defending, big fences. Dogs, watchdogs, and signs, you know, ADT, there's so many different companies they hire to protect their property. Once I was on a walk at White Rock Lake in Dallas, and White Rock Lake is, I think it's definitely the best place in Dallas, and there are many huge mansions along the lake, I mean really huge. And one, I think the hugest of all. So anyway, this one time, instead of walking along the lake, I walked up in the hills and just sort of wandering around and chanting, and then I came down. I saw like a little lane, a little street. Oh, this looks nice. I walked down it. And it turned out to run behind this huge estate that faces White Rock Lake. And, you know, just innocently walking along, chanting, and immediately these like ferocious dogs started bounding across this huge enclosed property, barking ferociously. And then like someone came out of the house. It's like, I was thinking, wow, these people are really afraid. No, I mean, I'm just chanting Hare Krishna. It's like it set off such alarm bells, like, oh, someone's going to attack someone. I was just like so afraid. When we first went to India, I mean, we were referred to very pious and aristocratic gentlemen who we approached to become like members. But sometimes we'd be in a neighborhood or a building and we didn't really have anyone more to see. So we said, we'll just ring a doorbell and, you know, see what kind of reception we get. And sometimes we were received nicely. Anyway, we were in this, like, in those days there were only a few high-rise apartment buildings in Bombay, and it was like a big thing, you know, wow, building such height. And like only very rich people lived there. And this person, we thought, okay, we'll just go to the top, you know, we'll ring the bell at the top. And the man opened the door, and I don't even remember what happened, but I was with my preaching partner, and afterwards I remember he commented, he was the epitome of uptivity. In other words, he's like so uptight. Just living on the top floor, he's very uptight. So this is, they're fearful materially. But then the next, and that's because they're not thinking of Krishna. They're conceiving of things separate from Krishna. Once a newspaper reporter asked Srila Prabhupada, because they would always try to get him to make some political statement, and especially during the war with Pakistan. And he didn't want to make a political statement. He wanted to give people spiritual knowledge. So finally, the reporter came to the point of, well, what if, I forget his name, Yahya Khan, whoever the Prime Minister of Pakistan was then, you know, what if he came and dropped a bomb on me? And Srila Prabhupada said, well, I would think that Krishna wants to kill me now, and he's come in the form of Yahya Khan to kill me. So when someone sees Krishna's hand in everything, then the person is no longer afraid, doesn't see anything as separate from Krishna. And in the case of a devotee, Krishna does take personal care. It's not, again, like an illusion or wishful thinking, but it's a fact. And so often, something that appears to be bad in the end turns out to be good, because it's all being orchestrated by Krishna to bring us closer to Him, to take us out of the material world and bring us closer to Him. There are so many examples, even in the lives of our acharyas, even in all of our personal lives. I'm sure if I asked the devotees present in the room, can you think of some incident that seemed bad to you at the time, but in the end you could see that it was actually good, because something good came out of it that you never would have expected. We all have such experiences. In fact, one of our god sisters, well, our name Archana Siddhi, she is writing a book or compiling a book called When Bad is Good, with stories like that, that it was bad, or it looked bad, or we thought it was bad, but in the end it was good. Something came of it. And she likes to tell a story that I believe comes from Chinese folklore of a wise Chinese farmer who had two horses. And somehow one of the horses escaped and ran into the woods. So all the neighbors came and said, oh, how terrible. You have two horses and now one is gone. And the wise Chinese farmer said, maybe yes, maybe no. Anyway, he sent his son into the woods to try to find the lost horse. He couldn't find it. But he found two other horses in the woods and brought them home. So all the neighbors came and said, oh, how wonderful. You began with two horses, now you have three. And the wise Chinese farmer said, maybe yes, maybe no. So one of the new horses was a little wild, So the son had to break in the horse. And while he was trying to break in the horse threw him, and he broke his leg. So all the neighbors came, "Oh, how terrible. Your son has broken his leg." And the wise Chinese farmer said, "Maybe yes, maybe no." So the king's men came looking for the farmer's son to recruit him into the army. And they saw that the young man had a broken leg and was useless for military service. So they let him go. And all the neighbors came and said, "Oh, how wonderful! Your son escaped the draft." And the wise Chinese farmer said, "Maybe yes, maybe no." And like this, the story goes on. So we may be, you know, in a condition state is, "Oh, you know, someone stole my money. Oh, it's terrible." Something good could come out of it, you know, physically. So a devotee is not fearful like an ordinary person because he understands that there is nothing separate from Krishna, that everything is under the control of Krishna, and that Krishna is orchestrating things in the life of the devotee to teach him something or to bring him somehow or other closer to Krishna. So devotees are not, they're not afraid of material calamities, like Queen Kunti prayed, "Let the calamities come," because when there are calamities, I can see Krishna. In the face of calamities, I can see Krishna. And seeing Krishna means I no longer have to see the repetition of birth and death. So she welcomed calamities. So devotees are not afraid of material calamities, and they're not afraid of spiritual individuality, because they know that that has nothing to do with the body. That's the soul. The soul is not formless any more than God is formless. The soul has form. The soul is a person, just like Krishna. And as spiritual persons, we have an eternal relationship with Krishna as the supreme individual spiritual person. So it's very joyful and very blissful. And yes, the Vita Raga Vaya Krodha, and anger. Now, anger, people, you know, they're looking. Okay, it's typical of the gross materialist who's looking for material happiness. Things don't go his way, and he becomes angry. But even spiritualists, they're looking for some philosophy that can guide them, some process that can help them. But they're not really pious enough or intelligent enough to accept Krishna consciousness, but they just hear all these contradictions and they become angry. "I'm trying to get some guidance here and everybody's saying something different." Sometimes people approach us, you know, you say Krishna supreme, and other people say Shiva supreme, and someone else says Durga supreme, and then someone says bhakti is the way, and someone says jnana is the way, and they're like so confused and frustrated that they get angry. And when you're angry, you know, you just want to say punch someone in the face. But what does that mean, you want to punch them in the face? It really means you want to get rid of them. So when these people become angry, they want to like punch God in the face, punch the world in the face, punch everyone in the world in the face. It really means they want to get rid of it all. And then what's left? The void. The void. So this, the voidism, the underlying emotion of voidism is anger. And many, almost everyone, if not everyone, who is an atheist, has some underlying issues with God. It's very paradoxical. Because their official position is there's no God. By definition, atheist means there's no God. That's their official position. But underneath it all, they all have issues with God. Like, how could he allow so many innocent people to suffer? That's a big one. Or, how could he let so many terrible things happen to me? Therefore, he doesn't exist. But they actually are angry at him. They're actually angry at him. It comes out that he doesn't exist, but it's the same thing. I just want to punch him in the face and just never have to see him again. And a lot of people who claim to be atheists actually spend a lot of time thinking about God negatively. Like this Dawkins, he writes books. There are others too, they write books saying that God doesn't exist. Why? They're angry.
Well, he doesn't exist.
I mean, if he didn't exist, say, I don't know what's a good example, but say the Tooth Fairy. Anyway, I don't mind. Burst any benign bubbles of illusion. But let us say the Tooth Fairy does not exist. People don't write books that the Tooth Fairy does not exist. It's not an issue. But it's a real big issue that God doesn't exist. But why? If he doesn't exist, what's the issue? But he does exist. But they have issues. And in their sort of childish, primitive, emotional way of trying to deal with their anger, they just say it doesn't exist. So, Vita Raga Vaya Krodha. So, you want to go beyond those. So, that's all the negative. You want to get rid of all of that baggage, they say. And then what? You know, Madhashai, we take shelter of Krishna, become absorbed in Krishna, because these are the main impediments to taking shelter of Krishna and becoming Krishna conscious. You're either too materially absorbed, or you're afraid of spiritual individuality, or you're angry. So without those impediments, you can take shelter of Krishna and think of him. And then what is the result? This is very nice, that many, many people in the past attained bhava by taking refuge in Krishna and being absorbed in Krishna. Now, this is very encouraging, especially because when we talk about the past, yes, it goes back thousands of years, millions of years. There's histories of people recorded in Srimad Bhagavatam who took shelter of Krishna, became absorbed in Krishna, developed love of Krishna. There's so many examples that are actually very relevant to us. But still, someone could think, well, that was then. You know, people were more pious then, the conditions were more congenial. Then we have the example of our acharyas, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, so many six Goswamis. One would say, well, they were not ordinary people from the beginning. They were eternal associates of the Lord who came into the material world with a mission to serve the Lord. So where is the example of someone like us, you know, living in the 20th century or 21st century, who attained transcendental love for Krishna? Well, there are examples of disciples of Srila Prabhupada, even grand disciples. And their stories have been told by people who've been close to them. There was one. There's so many. Many, just like the verse says, many, many. Just in the last, I think, week or 10 days, a very special devotee in Germany. She was His Holiness Sachinanda Swami's secretary. She left her body, and it seems that she went back to Godhead. It really seems that she went back to Godhead. And there are many, many. They were not extraordinary. Not all of them were extraordinary in the sense that not all of them were, you know, world preachers. You know, many of them were not so well known outside of the immediate circle of people who knew them. But they did achieve success in spiritual life and Krishna consciousness basically by following the process that Srila Prabhupada has given us. Of course, they were serious about it, no doubt. They were sincere. But they were not so extraordinary, like, you know, traveling, giving lectures to thousands of people, writing books, you know, leading kirtans, and thousands of people dancing in ecstasy. But they were sincere servants of Srila Prabhupada and his mission and his devotees. And when you read their stories, as I happened to read just maybe 3 days ago, the report of, I think her name was Sadanandini, of her passing, it's very encouraging. It's very encouraging. So it's possible, it's attainable. You know, know, someone asks you, the Prabhupada, will all of your disciples go back to Godhead? And he said, only the serious ones. But that's open to any of us. You don't have to do anything extraordinary, but you do have to be serious. But if you are, and, you know, go beyond these, the lingering vestiges of, you know, material attachment, fear of spiritual individuality and anger, then there's no reason why you can't progress through these stages. Ado, Shraddha, Tata, Sadhu, Sangha, Tata, Bhajana, Kriya, Anarthana, Vritti, Syat. And this stage of Anarthana Vritti, this stage is quite crucial. When I came to the San Diego temple in the morning, I was thinking, oh, the morning program's so nice. Greeting the deity, Guru Puja, and everything's so nice. And later, I met with Dravida Prabhu. He was talking about Vyasa Puja offerings, because the deadline for Vyasa Puja offerings is April 15th. And he's the editor of the Vyasa Puja book. So anyway, you know, we discussed, well, are you going to write one? He said, yes, he's thinking he will write one. And the subject was, he's planning to write on is the morning program. Like, what a wonderful gift the morning program is to us. So, quite often when we, you know, first start coming, we relish all the activities of Krishna consciousness. But then this, we go through this phase, Anartha Vritti, where we confront anarthas. Anarthas are unwanted habits, unwanted, yeah, it could be mental habits, it could be physical habits. And then we start to wonder, you know, how am I going to get through this? Or am I ever going to get through this? So this stage is something that you progress through. His Holiness Bhakti Chaitanya Swami has given a nice course at the VIHE, Vrindavan Institute for Higher Education, called Demons of Vrindavan. And our Acharya Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has explained that the main demons that Krishna killed correspond to different anarthas. And that by hearing the stories or reading the stories means histories of Krishna killing these demons, even if you're not aware of the anartha that the demon corresponds to, just hearing it will have the effect of freeing you from that anartha. And one, the first, generally the first is Putana. She was the first that Krishna killed. And she corresponds to the false guru, because she posed herself as like a very beautiful mother figure. But actually, her breasts were not, I mean, there was milk in her breasts, but her breasts were covered with poison. She wasn't coming to nourish Krishna, she was coming to kill him. So there are many false gurus out there, and you know, that's part of Kali Yuga. That's part of Kali Yuga. But even after we begin devotional service, we can also be influenced by these false gurus who come in different guises and give us ideas that are not really favorable to Krishna consciousness, but we might believe they are. But anyway, that's just one example. And he begins the course with the second class, I would say, is called the Anatomy of the Cloud of Anartha. And it's based largely on a small book by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, and called Madhurya Kadambini, in which he analyzes this, say, from Bhajana Kriya, when you first start practicing Krishna consciousness, what are the main anarthas you face then? And then at the beginning of the next stage of anartha vritti, what are the main anarthas you face then? And then even as you're coming out of the stage of anartha vritti, there are other anarthas that you face then. They become increasingly more subtle. So that's very helpful to know, because otherwise you hear these different stages like we just read, and then there's an artha nivritti, and like, it's like you're stuck there. It's like you're not making any progress. I remember years ago, I don't even, you know, maybe 30 years ago, I met a godbrother of mine after, yeah, we hadn't seen each other for many years. And at the time I was studying the Nectar of Devotion. So I thought, well, you know, why don't we, can I discuss the Nectar of Devotion? So he said, well, you know, I've been practicing Krishna consciousness for 5 years. You know, and I look at the Nectar of Devotion, I don't know if, yeah, I mean, maybe I've advanced one page out of that 350-page book. But actually, when you see that range within that, from Bhajana Kriya, beginning stage of the Narasimhavritti, middle stage, and stage of the Narasimhavritti, you can see that you're making progress. And it's actually very helpful to know what those anarthas are, because otherwise there's just sort of a vague feeling of maybe not making that much advancement. But when you actually know what they are, then you can identify them and, you know, sort of reject them. It's sort of like, the Chaitanya Charitamrita says that when you get the seed of devotional service, you should water it. And then you should be careful of weeds, because weeds can grow up alongside of the devotional creeper, and then the water, which is chanting and hearing, the water that's meant to nourish the bhakti vata will be sucked up by the weeds. And Lord Chaitanya says, but the weeds can resemble, very closely resemble, the creeper. So it's like it can be sort of a tangled mess, and you're not really clear about what's what, but it's just not flourishing. Your devotional creeper is not flourishing. But this analysis, with practical examples, very helpful. We can see, oh, this is me, you know. This is me. And then you can see also the difference. Well, that happened to me a lot when I first joined. That actually doesn't happen to me. But you see there's sort of the middle range of anarthas. You might even say, well, that doesn't even happen to me that much. But then there's sort of like the stage when you're just about to come out of an arthritis, where it's more subtle. Like an example of an anartha at that stage would be getting angry. You know, getting angry at someone losing your temper. You're not breaking any of the four regulative, you know, it's not as gross, but it's still an anartha. You're getting angry, you're losing your temper, you're speaking harshly. But it's more subtle. So by this analysis, you can see that actually, yes, I am making progress. I have anarthas, but now I'm dealing with more subtle ones. I'm not dealing with those gross ones. And so there's actually quite a significant difference. One can actually have made significant progress. And then when you come out from that cloud, then things are very simple. Like, and then the morning program, it's like it's just so relishable, sort of like when you first joined. Anarthas, and especially offenses, aparadhas, they don't exist until you're a devotee. Because an offense is something that you do knowingly. Like, say in deity worship, the first offense is to enter the temple room wearing shoes. Now a completely new person who walks in the temple for the first time might come in the temple wearing shoes. If there's no sign, if he doesn't see that other shoes are left outside the door, he might just innocently walk in the temple wearing shoes. That's not an offense, because he didn't know. It's a mistake, but it's not an offense. So offenses begin to operate when you have knowledge. So anyway, it's quite an intricate science, quite an intricate science, but the conclusion is that if you just stick to it and take advantage of the books we have, the instructions that Srila Prabhupada has given, and the previous acharyas, and the contemporary devotees, you can get like helped step by step through all, like what we just read, Adosha, Adhita, Sadhu, Sangha, Bhajna, Kriya, all the way to Bhava, which is ecstatic love of Godhead. And we just keep chanting. It's Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And just keep chanting. The chanting will wash away all this stuff. Just keep chanting. Just wash it all away. And it's so simple. But as Prabhupada said, chanting is easy, but the determination to keep chanting is not so easy. But chanting is easy. And if you just keep chanting, all that stuff will be washed away. Especially, this, back to the morning program. Get up early in the morning, chant your rounds or most of your rounds in the morning. It really has powerful effects. And then you become like Dravida Prabhu, you know, a devotee of 40 years or whatever, writing about the glories of the morning program that we experienced the first day we attended the morning program. And he's relishing it, and not just relishing, appreciating the potency of it, and appreciating Prabhupada for giving it to us. Because it there are different elements were added to the morning program over the first few years of this kind. Prabhupada added elements to it. And now it's, you know, it really focuses on the main, most potent angas, limbs, or practices of devotional service. They're all built into the morning program. But the chanting, the main thing, of course, is the chanting. So, it's very interesting. One of my godbrothers, Tamalakrishna Goswami, he left he's left this world of the body. But he has a brother and sister-in-law who are very nice devotees. And so the sister-in-law had a very, she was like a sister with him. You know, his brother actually asked him for initiation. And Tamalakrishna Goswami said, you know, I have so many hundreds of disciples, but I only have one brother. And I don't want to lose my brother to get another disciples. But I'll guide you, I'll take care of you spiritually, I'll do everything. But I don't want to initiate you because that will change the relationship and I don't want to lose my brother. So anyway, and so he had a similar relationship with his brother's sister. She was like his sister. And she told me that he would always tell her three words. And those three words were like the guiding principle in Krishna consciousness. And the three words were, I love you. And she also he also repeated three words to his brother. All the time, three words. And the three words he would repeat to his brother were, don't stop now. Don't stop now. So, that's, if you don't, just don't stop. Just keep going. Krishna loves you. And in the end, you will be successful. No doubt. Absolutely no doubt. You just keep chanting and dancing and hearing service. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So are there any questions or comments? Yes, sir.
It's the bhav, what will be the English equivalent of bhav?
Yes.
Expression or thought?
Yes, well, you know, like in any language, Sanskrit words have different meanings in different contexts. So bhav sometimes can just mean mood. But in this context, bhava is translated by Srila Prabhupada as ecstatic love of Godhead. It's beyond the senses, it's beyond the mind. It's something that takes place on the spiritual plane.